Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I feel like I'm jogging.
Jogging where?
I'm jogging through the windmills of my mind.
The windmills of your mind? What yes. Are they like? Is it like...
There are corridors.
Corridors?
There are long hallways.
Are they tiled?
They are tiled with these kind of like white square tiles.
Like 1970s style?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you wearing heels?
I am wearing heels.
And what noise are you making?
Kind of like clickety-clack.
Oh my God.
And I feel really good about myself.
Yeah, I feel good about that as well.
And the reason I feel like I'm jogging is because today's guest has actually been a constant... through my whole experience in the art world. And I sort of realized it as I was researching this episode, because I had no idea. Like, we don't sort of text each other. We're not like friends in the sense that, you know, like you and I are, we talk every day, that kind of thing. But our guest today is somebody that has been there the whole time that I've sort of been visiting galleries. And we met when I was really young. I think when we were like maybe 26 or something, like mid-2000s. I've sort of seen her grow like over the same time that I've been growing in the art world. And it's been an amazing privilege to see the kind of way you've just like rocketed basically and taken over the world in many ways, because you've now shown your work all over the world.
Yeah,
even in the Venice Biennale last year, and in the Tate Museum in London a number of times. Yeah, and I've been very, very inspired by today's guest. There was a show in 2012 in Colchester at First Sight, which is pretty much one of the best exhibitions I probably ever saw by anybody.
Was it a solo?
It was a solo exhibition curated by Michelle Cotton. And I actually went to the preview or the opening of that and hung out with today's guest. Yeah, and that show still to this day like sticks in my mind. So that is in the windmills of my mind.
Amazing.
And yeah, so we're very proud to be speaking with Anthea Hamilton.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing today, Anthea?
I'm all right. You guys are smooth. That was good.
We did sort of choreograph that one slightly before you turned up.
Thanks.
It's all for you. So I'm going to start off with saying that you are a Turner nominee. In 2016, you were nominated for the Turner Prize. Now, I want to ask a question, because everything doing research, it says Turner nominee, Turner nominee. So how does that feel for an artist that forever will be a handle that is going to be bracketed by your name when people talk about you in the art world?
Yeah, I guess I always try and pull it off.
Like,
I always try and take, you know, you kind of think, well, I was alive before that moment. I was doing other things. And this was just like a kind of really busy 6 months of my life when that show is happening. And you think, I don't know, you're kind of, it's interesting. It's kind of something that once you go through it, you understand, you can look at other people who've been through it in a different way, because it kind of does alter your perception on, I don't know, exhibition making or Turner Prize making and things like that. So it's kind of more like a, how would you say it? I don't know how you would say it. I'll come back to
it. Is it like once you've been through the gauntlet, then you can have that, when you're saying that other Turner nominees or winners, you can all connect and go like, that experience was crazy. Wasn't that a mad thing? And now we're all at the other side. And isn't that weird that we've had that experience?
I guess it's because it's like exhibition making beforehand, or being working as an artist before. It's a very private experience, right? That like you're just kind of in your studio with your peers,
right,
with people that you want to speak to, or you think you can understand what people outside of your kind of close network are thinking about or reacting to with your work. And then you go through that process and then you realise that, oh, I've probably had it completely wrong. And in fact, we live in we're kind of practicing quite a limited space, which is nothing wrong with that, especially. But yeah, it kind of pulls you into a different, I don't know. I felt like I kind of went above the radar for a little while. And then it's like, oh, I just can't wait to go back under the rug.
Really?
Yeah, and the thing is, with the Turner Prize, you suddenly have this massive audience of people that have maybe never even heard of your work or knew you existed or anything. And you're presenting your ideas to like this massive kind of mainstream audience. I mean, I've seen it this year in Margate with the Turner Prize. And it's fascinating the kinds of different audiences you suddenly are, you know, presenting your work to. Mm. Whereas if you think back to that show in Colchester that I came to, there was only like 10 of us there or something that day, and we were walking around with you, and it was very personal and private, and I don't know. So yeah, it is.
And also that year it was at Tate Modern, right? No, Tate Britain. Where was
Tate Britain?
The Tate Britain was that, and that, so that in itself is going to have a massive audience. Like the one in Margate has been like a bit of a trailblazer because so many people have travelled to Margate for
The Turner Prize this year. Yeah, but I guess the proximity as well to the rest of the country, like getting to Margate is actually quite easy on the train compared to other places where it's been, I think.
But having a Turner Prize at the Tate is like an event in itself as well, isn't it?
I guess so, because I guess you also start to understand that these things about the Tate's idea of how to present contemporary art in a kind of a very broad way also. Mm-hmm. So it's not just, you kind of find yourself participating in this kind of very public way of explaining what contemporary art is to people who have their own ideas anyway. So it kind of gets doubled down within that. Yeah, I remember waking up at one point during the process and thinking, oh, I'm going to make a big bum for the Turner Prize.
That's right.
Whoops. You know, like maybe that wasn't the way to go with that one.
So you felt like that because of the prize, you were going to think on that scale? Do you think you might not have come up with that idea at that time?
You'd made it before that, hadn't you, in New York?
No, it was for the Sculpture Centre. Yeah. And because it was for New York, it felt like you could do anything in New York. You know, they've seen it all. They see big bums, you know, 24/7. You know?
Yeah, also, the initial idea that you were responding to was another artist's drawings, you know, like a proposal by Gaetano Pesce.
Pesce. He's one of the radical Italian designers from the late 60s, early 70s. He's still practicing now and doing many other things. And I think I like this idea of this proposal that was a ridiculous idea. Something which no one would ever go for.
So you'd walk through the butthole and that would be the entrance to an apartment block in Manhattan.
Yeah, on the Upper East Side. So, you know, just kind of like the wealthiest of the wealthiest in New York kind of...
Would walk through a bumhole to get home.
Yeah, to get home.
And
if you haven't seen this and you're listening, it's like a giant, giant... backside. Like
what was it
going to
be made
bum.
Out of? Like
his one.
Yeah.
I don't know. Bricks and mortar, probably. Oh, I guess Gaetano's practice is very much kind of focused on like new materials. And the reason why he had made that model was because silicon rubber was a new thing, and he wanted to know what silicon could do.
Ah.
And so he was like, oh, well, let's.
But was he upset at the time that it never came to fruition?
Oh, I think it was just a folly.
A folly.
Yeah,
right.
he was just giving it a go, or just kind of pointing out how conservative architecture, even in its wildest, tends to be.
Yeah. Right. How shocking that would have been.
Yeah.
So why did you connect with that big bum, and why did you want to bring that?
Why? I think the truth of it is that when I went for the meeting with Ruba Katrup, who was the curator I was working with at the Sculpture Centre,
I love her. I think she's an incredible curator.
I think she kind of changed. She definitely has changed the way in which I've worked also.
Like really?
Very free, very, but also very involved, but in a different way to other curators I've worked with.
Do you like a curator to be quite involved in your work?
Very much so.
Oh, really?
I think I'm quite needy when I work with someone. I'm just, I need a lot of hand-holding and a lot of nagging also.
Yeah. And would you like a curator to tell you if you're doing good or doing bad at the same time? Like me as an actor, I want a director to tell me, give me notes, but also when I'm doing a good job, I want them to like hold my hand and go... Thumbs up, that's really cool.
I don't know, just like a lot. I just want a lot. I don't mind getting a lot of criticism, being told it's no good or think it again or do it again or just a lot. I think a lot of contact, because I kind of think that's kind of how I get energy for things. Like I need to have people around me a lot, and so a lot of things happen in conversation.
I can
spend ages on my own in the studio and then have a meeting and then resolve the whole thing. I think why didn't we do this at the beginning?
But you're a big collaborator, aren't you?
Yeah.
Like you like to collaborate with other artists, but also you see your audience as collaborating in your work as well, right?
I guess so. And like maybe that was something... Well, yeah, definitely, I guess so. Because, you know, they're the ones who look at it too. Like I'm looking at it once and then they see it another way. And I don't necessarily think that my way is the only way in which something can happen.
Mm.
Yeah.
So with Ruba, when you were working with her in New York, so what was the process of you... You had like documentation of that... you know, folly, this idea of that giant bum, and that was in your own archive, because you keep a kind of archive, do you, of things found that inspired you?
Yeah, it's not very special. Maybe it's, but I think maybe the thing that's particular about it is a lot of images,
right?
Or printed images, these kind of like quite fixed things.
Yeah.
And so I had a meeting with Ruba. She's, you know, the sculpture centre is this big brick building. And she's like, can you think of something big to do? And I didn't necessarily have like a wealth of ideas.
Yeah.
You know, I just had a kid at this time, so kind of my mind was elsewhere. And so it kind of came up as a conversation point. I've taught quite a lot. I've done a lot of artist talks, and I always show a picture of the model.
Oh, really?
And just as a way, like, you know, can someone, like if someone shares the same sense of humour as me, that's normally like a good starting point for working with someone, right? Like if you kind of laugh at the same things or be upset by the same things, you know,
yeah.
You can kind of share stuff. And so I kind of showed it to her and said, well, this is interesting to me. And she was quite like, okay, I think we can do that. And that kind of yes.
That's so cool.
Was enough.
So was you not expect? You wasn't expecting her to be like, let's make this massive.
Yeah, I guess so. I thought there might be a bit more, but I kind of, it's like, well, I can't like this idea in collaboration or improvisation that you need a yes to kind of keep it going,
course,
right?
That
like you can't kind of shut things down.
Yeah.
And that yes, even though it was to like a big but, meant that there were lots of other things that had to be resolved, right? Like it wasn't the entirety of the show. It's like, how do you then make everything else make sense in relation to this?
And actually, that exhibition had a really great suit hanging in air, basically, with red bricks printed onto the suit. And you've used like clothes and that material of like fabric, like cotton or different materials throughout your whole career, really. And how did that come about? Was that responding again to the building? Like you were talking about the sense of it being bricks, because there was something quite surreal about that as well. Like,
It felt to me like a Joseph Beuys felt suit as well. That's what it reminds me of. Did you ever like have that sort of image in your mind?
Maybe not. I think it's too art-based a reference. Right, I think I had been looking at like a lot of what Moschino fashions, and there had been a suit in one of those collections, I think 96 or 97.
Wow.
And I thought, this is a really good way to be in the city, kind of camouflaging, but also completely standing out at the same time. And so it was a remake of that, or my own version of that. And that was from 2010, and it was initially sparked as, what would you call it, like a commission or a product for House of Voltaire when they did their first iteration of the shop.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was meant to be something that people could have, and it was a bespoke item.
And the House of Voltaire is an offshoot of Studio Voltaire, which is an institution in Clapham in London, which is run by an amazing guy called Joe Scotland. And House of Voltaire is a fundraiser that they do biannually or every year.
Almost like every year.
Yeah.
Every year.
And they even have a website as well.
And a lot of artists contribute works of art that go towards funding the studio programme.
And actually, Russell and I were talking yesterday, we both have your fan.
Yeah,
that you made. An edition of a fan, which came in a beautiful box as well with a kind of like gold writing on it or whatever. It was a really beautiful edition.
Yeah, so going back to the bum and the architect, Gaetano Pesce. Good, that sounds more Italian than me. He's still alive, and is he aware that this work was created?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to meet him. I thought if I'm going to kind of invest in kind of remaking somebody's work, I thought it would be good to try and meet them in case they were not someone whose work I wanted to kind of...
You meet him and you're like, oh, yeah, no.
I mean, yeah, it was great. I mean, I was completely lost in the moment. I was like a fangirl.
Oh, so you did actually meet him?
Yeah,
So how did that come about? Did you?
There was like an amazing kind of... That whole show was kind of an amazing moment of lots of different people coming together. So also... there was a link through Valeria Napoleoni, who's a patron, who was at that time starting to support the Sculpture Centre, who had a personal connection to Gaetano. So then there was a chance to have the introduction.
Oh, wow.
So we went
Is
to
she
his...
Italian, Napoleoni?
Yeah.
Yes, right, okay.
So we went to his studio on Broadway in New York.
Oh, my God.
Oh, so he's based in New York as well?
Yeah, he's based in New York. He has his studio out in Brooklyn and then is also working in Milan also.
How old is he now?
I think he must be late 80s, 87.
So what was that like then?
I mean, I lost it. I couldn't really speak. You know,
like really got shy.
Proper fangirling. Like.
I know, I don't often do that.
Was you a fan of him before The Bum anyway?
Before The Bum?
Yeah.
I think, yeah. I used to go to the library all the time, really kind of really geeky, and just like, look at all these books.
Yeah.
And his was the one that I was always like, this is I should have brought it along, got him to sign it or something. Because, yeah, and he had, you know, it's this kind of an amazing relationship to materials that all of the works, all these kind of furniture pieces or design pieces, they just kind of rely on the materials doing whatever it is that they want to do and kind of shaping that. And so,
was he a nice guy?
Yeah, he was. And I couldn't speak. I didn't know what to say. I felt kind of like a...
You meet a hero.
Naive. Yeah, I was very naive, and I felt like I didn't have much kind of ground to stand on.
It must have been quite interesting for him because it was an unrealised project.
Yeah.
And then somehow there's a younger artist who's, you know, like been inspired
50,
by
50
his work
years
and
later
then
or something.
Helping to realise it, but in a new way and in a new context as well.
Yeah, I still feel like we haven't really realised it because it's still not on that apartment
Where
building.
Is it now?
Oh, yeah.
The bum.
Yeah.
Well, there was two of them. I've got parts of it in my studio.
But little really? Bits of bum.
Yeah, fingers.
Fingers of bum.
Fingers and bum. Fingers.
Oh, fingers. Oh, fingers. Oh, the fingers are holding the bum apart.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
You've got those.
Yeah, so you're right. It's not. It's actually a very different work, isn't it, to what he imagined? Because you've somehow
put it in a gallery
space. Something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's still reframing. It's kind of scaled up, but it's still a proposal. It's a quotation of a proposal. So it's It's kind of. More...
Would you ever build a house one day and put that as your doorway?
Why not?
Exactly. Good.
If you can, why not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you said you're a geek, which I love that about you. Is that a good thing?
It's a bit tiring, really.
Right. Being a geek?
Not really a geek, just being like, I don't know. I'd say so. I'm quite delicate. I get really tired really easily.
Do you?
Yeah.
But you need lots of information to come your way because of that kind of strivingness to know everything. Like, where do you find all your images and stuff? Is it junk shops or just...
Not so, I guess it used to be. I think I might start again, like going to flea markets and stuff. I think I had a big purge. Mm. I think I've kind of met somewhere between wanting to be an absolute minimalist,
yeah,
but also liking lots of stuff.
Same.
And I don't know where I should be on that.
I know.
I read a really good quote that you said once about... one of the, because you've used different kind of cultural references throughout your work, and one of them was the Kabuki theater, and you said that there was this kind of paradox between the kind of overly theatrical and expressive and kind of like hyper real in a way, and then the very kind of pragmatic, almost like, you know, very down to earth, sensible side to it, and that you have these kind of two opposing energies, which when I read that, I was like, that kind of is what I would describe what you do in a way, like within a lot of your work. You mm-hmm. have these kind of like contrasts the whole time mm. of like very overtly expressive, theatrical kind of expressions mm. Versus very kind of matter of fact, everyday kind of, I don't know.
Mundanities,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because your references,
or materials.
The everyday is kind of like a lot of your references.
Yeah, I guess I'm always just like trying to process. I think a lot of my work is about just trying to think about what it is I'm doing on a day-to-day basis, and being an artist doing that. Like, you know, what do you do when you're suddenly offered a commission in the middle of Tate Britain? Like, how do you kind of deal with that?
How did you deal with that? What did that feel like?
I think the first thing, I don't know. I think I did a lot of hand-holding through that.
You did.
Praise to...
I can imagine that. It must be such a sort of...
honour, but
to
terrifying.
It's huge as well, that space.
I don't think it's the size of things
really,
that matters. It's more like the institution, the weight of the institution's impression of itself, kind of
Got
offering
it.
Itself to you. You know, like it's just it's a corridor really that leads to
into
the cafe.
Other rooms.
Yeah. Straight
it's
down
a corridor
to that cafe.
That leads to the cafe.
It is. You know, like when you watch people in there. That's actually what's happening. They're kind of like moving through, and then either going to the shop, the loo, the cafe, or leaving. You know, that's,
right.
You know that space there, particularly. So you have to think, like, you know, how interested are people really in looking in those spaces? It's different to a commercial gallery where you do make that journey, or it's different to, I don't know, a space like the Tate is somewhere that people, not everyone, but people do pass through, or you know, there is an expected kind of way of behaving in that space,
yeah.
Which is kind of. As many things.
But I think what you ended up creating, so for people who didn't see this, it was a few years ago, and Anthea actually tiled the whole of the Davine
with
galleries.
With the white tiles that you clickety-clack along.
Yeah, which I referenced in the introduction to this podcast. But the very square, you created this kind of grid, which if you think about the history of art in painting and many different things, even in Kabuki theatre, you often have these kind of grid-shaped floors. And it almost created a kind of, well, it was like a platform, wasn't it, for the performers that you had dancers who you had worked with J.W. Anderson, Jonathan Anderson, the fashion designer, to develop an earlier idea that you had
from a photograph, another found photograph of a man dressed as a vegetable.
Latin American performance artist.
As a squash.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. And so you created these characters that had this squash head, and they inhabited this world that you created in the Davine Galleries at the Tate Britain. How did that, the concept of that, how did that all come about then? How did, from when they said, right, this is what you're going to do, and this is how, what you come up with?
I think the only thing that I did know that I wanted was that I wanted there to be one person in the gallery at all time. That was the only thing I knew for months and months and months, is that there needed to be one person in there the whole time, you know, for the duration.
As a performer?
I wasn't even sure. I didn't even necessarily think of them as performers. They were just one person present for the duration. And the rest of it was a very long process of trying to figure out what would need to happen to make that so, to kind of look after them, to give them a space, to, I don't know. I didn't think anyone actually would be bothered at all. I didn't think any audience person would be bothered to, that there could be like one person kind of slouching about in a museum.
Yeah.
I didn't think that would be a point of interest. It was just about like, what could I do for the person who was going to be in there that would kind of give them something to latch onto for their period of being in there. So the first thing that happened was, well, thinking that I didn't want them to be on the museum floor because that's too coded, you know, that kind of speaks of like pomp and neoclassicalism. And, and so let's get rid of that floor straight away. And then the only thing you can really afford at that kind of scale is the cheapest white tiles.
Yeah.
Going.
Mm.
Yeah. So then that was kind of one way of dealing with it. And it's like, well,
how did the museum react to that? How did you affix the tiles to the flooring?
Oh, well, the curator, I worked with Lindsay Young, who's the curator of British contemporary art there, who's also was the curator for the Turner Prize. So I felt like Lindsay and
good
I
were... Good handholder.
Great handholder. Fantastic.
She's an amazing human being generally. And she's somebody who's been putting on shows for the last kind of 10 years, like in different spaces. And I used to go to some of the ones in East London. And they were just like the best thing I'd seen. It would be an artist you'd never heard of. And it's before she was working at Tate. And then when she got that job at the Tate, I was like screaming from the rooftops how happy I was, because it was like, it felt like such a kind of genuine person that cared about art had actually been given a responsible position within a powerful place, if you know what I mean. Mm. And I think it's so important, and I'm so glad. And she's gone on to do things in Venice as well, hasn't she?
She was the curator for Scotland and Venice with Charlotte Prodger last.
Yeah, again, which was amazing. And yeah, I feel like she's definitely helping give a platform for important voices to be heard in a way. Like, she's brilliant.
So tell us about the tiles. So the tiles, getting them on the floor, how does she help you do that?
She innovated a system that I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
She was very good at not having me
worry.
Yes.
About
stuff that wasn't too much for me to worry about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So she's actually pioneered a new system that you need to speak to her about.
Great. Wow.
We'll get her on.
Get her on.
She was good with the kind of...
She's going to move into...
The facilitating the practicality of it all.
Yeah, Tyler.
If you're doing your next bathroom, you could have an...
I want it.
Yeah, coordinated.
The thing I thought was really successful about the titles was, A, it was such a shock. Like, because like you're saying, we all go through those Davine halls, and even if there's art installed in there, often it is just kind of a place you're walking through because you're going to see an exhibition in another room or see a permanent collection.
You take for granted how you're going to receive art.
Whereas when I walked in there with the tiles, it was such a shock. A lot of, because of the fact it was so bright as well. There was this kind of like light that was created from those tiles, but also it made the space feel so much longer.
But it made space feel geometric.
Yeah, and kind of like endless. It was like almost like, you know, the computer games.
Yes, that's right.
That you kind of go into.
Yeah, and you're, like Tron you're in, or
yes,
something
exactly
like that.
Yes, exactly that.
Yes, 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 yes. Yeah. Made me think,
and I don't mean to be all like projecting onto your work something that isn't there, because that's not cool. But that was the experience I had when I walked in there. And then to see these figures, because you created kind of like nooks and crannies almost, like where people could like sit, like chairs or... And you also had plinths with sculptures on them, but even the plinths had the tiles on. So it became this... What surrounded you? It was a real environment to sort of walk into. But I found that incredibly sort of successful because of that surprise, I guess, when you first walked in there.
I guess that's that thing about, you say, maybe being pragmatic, is that often when something is pragmatic, it normally is a surprise because it's the most straightforward solution.
Right.
Is that really the most straightforward solution? And yeah, it is somehow. But then there was all these other kind of levels to it, because I didn't know what I wanted to do for a really long time. And then this kind of figure, this kind of performance figure that came from the image seemed to hold true somehow. Then I would keep having meetings and they would say, what is going to happen? And I'd be like, I don't know. I don't know. Like, maybe it's not up to me to know. And so it was quite like a hard task of trying to hold on to keeping the commission, yeah. But at the same time as...
Oh, was really, they? But did you feel like they were like having second like doubts about what you were propositioning? Or
I'm not sure. I wasn't proposing anything. In my head, it was starting to make sense. Yeah. But we go to the meeting and they say, "What's going to be in there?" And I'm like, "Oh, maybe a pumpkin." And then I, "What's a pumpkin going to do?" Oh, I don't know. What's it going to be made out of?
Yeah,
I'm not sure. Yeah, and it went on like that for ages. Which I guess is this thing that you do. Maybe other people do that in their studio where they hold on to the unsurety, but I kind of do that all in the room with other people.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the initial photograph that you saw by this performance artist, you then did the first iteration of that at the Serpentine, where you had just one dancer and one figure in an event, wasn't it? Was it for Park Nights or one of those?
It was the magazine sessions, which was supported by the Fiorucci Art Trust and the Serpentine. Okay. And that was kind of a really long performance. I'd spent years before thinking that mime was a very, very important thing that had been overlooked. Mm. Kind of thought it, but I quite like the idea that it was this really passé kind of art form, or that people don't like it.
Right.
I like that. You know, like if a mime comes up to you in the street, you're like, "Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that."
It almost repels people, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I quite like this idea of being trapped in a room with something that you don't want to look at.
Right.
Which is a mime performance. So I kept offering this kind of mime performance. I'd like to do this mime performance based on this another architecture project by Mario Bellini and see how that's going. But it was never successful, and it was always really cringy, and it kind of always went wrong. And I think for those of us who were involved in it, it was kind of interesting, but to look at from the outside, it was always not very exciting.
What, the actual one you did?
Well, I think in the end at the Serpentine, what happened was I realised that if you could just ask people to be stuck in, at the Serpentine it was kind of like a captive audience, and so I kind of could force them to kind of watch a mime performance for about an hour and a half.
Wow.
Yeah, that's quite a long time, isn't
that's
it?
Quite a long time for someone just to be trying to get out of a wall.
I know.
Doing that hand thing up against the
wall. I know exactly.
So did you have any voice in the choreography of that?
I worked with an amazing movement director called Delphine Gabarin, who is able to translate
my mind, yes.
Which she just kind of sees me kind of flubbering, and then she's like, "Ah, you mean this?" I'm like, "Yeah, that's exactly what I mean."
Wow.
Yeah, she's good.
So was she involved when you got people involved at the tape, when the squash came up there?
I think once I kind of had figured out that there was going to be a series of people performing, then Delphine was like the go-to straight away.
Wow.
And she was able to take this kind of mood board of images that I had,
yeah,
and kind of say to the guys, okay, when we did the auditions, it was really interesting. She was like, okay, let's try this and let's try this and let's try this.
How many people were you looking for?
I don't know. There was no set amount. In the end, we had 14, which was amazing. And there was more than 200 odd applicants.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
What I loved about it is that these were people from different walks of life creatively. So you had like break dancers, you had ballet dancers, you had people that did physical theatre, you had actors, right? And you just said to them, you perceive how you think this vegetable squash person moves through the space, right? You let them have like license for their own sort of creation in the space, which I think is wonderful. But there has to be, was there some sort of parameters you set for them all at this time? And how did you timetable 14 people to work throughout the whole time?
I think one of the main parameters was in there is that the people should never perform for the audience.
Right.
It's like, if people are crowding around you, you should not then kind of be jazz handing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, they're there for their reasons and you're here for your reasons, so let's keep that separate. So often they were sleeping and it's pretty boring, probably.
Mm.
I mean, I'd find it interesting, but it's probably pretty dull having to sit with this like heavy...
Was it quite heavy, the squash head?
Yeah. This kind of fiberglass, leather-clad kind of helmet.
Parameter itself, isn't it? The costume. Because the costume, the head is, you become this...
You can't see out of it forwards, you can only see down, right?
You could. There was like a tiny kind of...
Pinhole
at the end.
Okay.
Yeah, that people don't tell the tape. If we kind of kept that quiet, that no one could really see the whole time.
Right. But how long would they be performing? Would they have like an hour at a time and then they would like tap in, tap out with the next squash?
The rule for them was that they had to be there between 10 and 6 every day. But whether they could have just been in, the green room for the whole day if they wanted to. If they didn't feel like they wanted to go out there, they didn't have to at all. It was just kind of, they were being paid to be present in the museum. And then people, just kind of practically, there wasn't like a five-day shift, but then everyone, you know, gets busy and then they all swap around.
So did you only have one at a time? Because at the opening I went to, you had a number of people.
Oh, yeah, I think everyone was there. Everyone was there in the opening. And that was like a big party. I think that was also to celebrate the kind of all the hard work of it.
Yeah.
So at one point you had 14 movement, like, characters going around.
Oh, no, maybe. Oh, right, I'm exaggerating. So there were seven. Because when we went to Jonathan Anderson, and said, would you consider kind of working with us on the costumes, we didn't really know how many to ask for.
Right.
So we said, seven, you know, one for every day of the week, thinking that probably we'd have to bargain and we would get two. Yeah. But he's amazing and said, yeah, sure, whatever you need.
Wow.
Let us know whatever you want.
So Jonathan Anderson, who is now the head of Loewe, and that was J.W. Anderson at the time, his own brand, his own label, or was he Loewe then?
It was Loewe. It made real sense, actually, to kind of work with this kind of leather company, this kind of very luxurious leather company.
Spanish leather company, yeah.
Yeah, and then also, you know, I felt for these performers, they were going to be kind of stuck in the museum.
Yeah.
I wanted them to look amazing, you know, I wanted them to have their kind of best looks that they could have, and so it kind of was a moment to kind of bring that all together.
How did you start a relationship with Jonathan? Did you know him prior to the Devine Squash Man show?
A little bit. I think he had curated me into a show at the Loewe store in Madrid that he does, this Close Encounters series, and that was 2015, I think. And then I think maybe we had both been working on shows at the Hepworth Wakefield at the same time.
Right.
I was working on the rehanging of the Kettle's Yard collection, and he was working on the Disobedient Bodies show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so we both kind of, I don't know, had this kind of crossover between British modernism, different understandings of it, different approaches, but I think he'd seen my work in person at that time.
He's an amazing patron of the arts and a collector, and he collects your work. And currently now in the Loewe store on Bond Street, there is, which was at the Hepworth Wakefield show that you reimagined, is this big table that has these glass sculpted tears kind of pouring off of it that he has in store. So if anyone's passing the Loewe store, you have to go in and check it out. But it's amazing. But what is that like then, having work bought and then placed in a shop like that?
I think the only really stressful thing was how they on earth they got it up a spiral staircase
on the
first floor. And I can't, that work, I really like that work. It's this kind of blown glass to these slate tiles. But it's super fragile.
And right.
It's just, yeah, you always kind of get the report that, you know, it's like...
Has there been breakages?
Along the way, yeah. I think no one really knows. When we made it, it was made for a commission at the Palais de Tokyo in 2014. And I think we just kind of went with it. I worked with the glassblowers who were based in France at the time. And, you know, when you're just kind of winging it and you're trying things out, and it was a new process for them, and I'd never worked in glass before. And you just think, yeah, we'll just stick it on, and then you realise you have to move it, and
the thing I love about that table as well is that it's almost like molten lava. It kind of has this like volcanic energy to it. But then I also like the practicality of it, that you could maybe sit and use it. But is it actually not that easy to use?
It's not roped off in the store. I mean, I'm sure people go up and touch it. They were the opening night there
for sure.
Yeah,
yeah. No, I like that gamble. I like this idea that, you know, I made a point of not making painting, and I'm only just about making sculptures. You know, I want things to be inhabited or touched, or you know, like and I'm excited about like materials. I think I want other people to be so too. And I guess it is a volcano. It's called the volcano table, but it's meant to be like a business table, like where you do your business and your emails and your telephone calls.
Yeah.
It's got a vase for flowers.
And that was from a found image as well.
Yeah.
Do you remember where that one was found?
I was looking for some work of Gaetano Pesce's, and it came up on a blog. And I go back, every now and again, I go back to see if I can find out what those things were. You know, now there's more internet and more connections. And this one, I still can't
get the original source.
Yeah. I think I need to go to another level. I think sometimes I'm in touch with design historians, and quite often, they kind of go to these dead ends.
What is it about, like, architecture, and you saying you're a historian, because I would definitely say you're a historian, but what is it about that really you are inspired by for fine art?
Oh, I knew you can ask that.
Did you?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. It's kind of, maybe it's that I don't necessarily follow things. You know, like, I love Matisse. But I don't know, when you're having this kind of conversation, if that's really what you mean. Like, you know, I think it's sometimes I think growing up, I didn't know one could be an artist. I didn't know it was really like a career path.
Well, you wanted to be an accountant at one point, didn't you?
I was six. I love counting. I was like, yeah.
You're really good at maths.
Yeah. So it's like anything that I was good at, I was like, yeah, I'm just going to do that.
That's what I do. Part like any kid. Yeah.
Whatever I'm good at. And then I think I wanted to be an interior designer.
Oh, so design then is definitely a thing, like placing things in a room or like... Yeah.
And I think this idea of finding solutions also, like I was quite interested in what I thought advertising was, this idea of like having a brief and then trying to find like a solution that other people could understand, you know, this kind of... Yeah.
I remember when we first met, you were represented at the time by a gallery called Ibid in London. And there was one point where you were going to like take the gallery over for a summer and make it a studio. And you were going to live in the gallery because I guess they were between shows or something. And you said to me you were going to make a film. And I can't remember, but at the end of it, maybe you did make the film. But I remember you saying to me something like, you'd been making all these sets or sculptures that were going to be in the film, but you felt like they were enough and you didn't even necessarily need to make the film because the sculptures had become the narrative within the sculptures and the assemblage of like different objects and the relationship between them had become enough of a story or somehow. So some kind of, do you see what I mean? Like,
yeah, I remember that. I also remember that I kept asking people to film them. I kept like trying to film people.
That's right, yeah.
And I'd take days of people's time filming them and making them kind of just walk backwards and forth. And then I cut all of that stuff. None of it was in the film at all. I had people like laying naked, I had people kind of top-lived, all this kind of really, you know, taking up people's time and then just putting kind of stuff from books in instead. And I think even those sculptures kind of became redundant. Sometimes it's just about kind of bringing your mindset into the space with you so that other people know what you mean. Maybe that's what my work's become, is like trying to get people on board with how I kind of perceive things,
right,
so that they can see things on my terms as such.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've still got this thing about trying to make a film. I still feel like that's kind of what I thought I was going to do when I left art school in the end. I thought I'd probably come into filmmaking somehow.
What, as a writer-director?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's kind of slowly what I've been trying to do. You know, like I'm not necessarily the best at writing a narrative.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, maybe I'll study kind of set design instead. Yeah. So that's what all this kind of practice has been. Or,
yeah.
And that's what I remember, though, is this idea of set design, because that was almost like solving a problem. Because if you need to be an art director...
It's the theatricality that runs through all of your work with set design. It's like you're creating these immersive zones for your work to exist in and for people to inhabit. So it's like the audience activate your work in some ways. You need an audience.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and I guess that's where I don't know then now how to kind of pull back and frame that in a screen, because I like there can be like these multiple entry points or that there's no beginning or an end. I know a film doesn't necessarily have to have that, but how do you then put a limit on things? I studied painting, and the reason why I could never paint a picture is because I could never figure out what would happen when I reached the edge of the canvas or something. It's like, how do you know when to stop?
What it frustrated you if you paint the sides of the canvas, or do you go to the back, or does it have to continue? Or
not even as like wild as that. I was just like, well, if you want to put a picture on it, like what do you do when you get to the edge, but you might still have something more you want to say, you know?
Yeah.
So I was like, oh yeah, let's just make a sculpture instead and then put that in the room, and then the edge of the room is like the edge of the canvas in a way.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, it's more like that.
There's a lot of themes that come up in your work, a lot of motifs. The main one that I love is legs and the leg and the boot that goes on the leg, like the thigh length, knee length boot. Where does that fascination come from the legs? Because when I first saw your work, it was like these acrylic spread legs and the floating wooden legs on poles, and then you've got the wavy boots which you make out of marble or jasmonite, and then there's drawings of it. What is that?
Do you know what it was? It was like when I first left college, then I was looking for a way to get a sculpture off the floor, but I didn't want a plinth. And I thought, all right, what can I put the sculpture on just to get it about, you know, 3 feet off the floor?
Yeah.
And then it seemed to be like a pair of legs was the nearest thing to hand. You know, so I remember going to like the woodyard at the back of the studio and like getting some crappy wood out of there and then cutting a pair of legs out and then just sticking, putting the work on top of that. And then it suddenly was like, oh, I don't maybe need the thing on the top because the legs are kind of doing quite a lot already. So they can be, they were things which were quite expressive and did a lot of kind of narrative work or animating work to things, but without actually having to do very much because it's a body and it was usually clear it was like a female body because...
So do you think that people can project onto that already for what it is, what they think they see in it?
Yeah, I guess that's it. But they were also, you know, it wasn't clear necessarily what age they were or what ethnicity they were or, you know, like you couldn't, you know, it's not like your face, your hands are so expressive that they're going to give so much away from you. They were kind of giving you a lot but withholding a lot of information at the same time.
Yeah, there was still like an ambiguity within them. I also think, if you think back to, for example, the Chisenhill show you did in 2008 and then the First Sight show later in 2012, like those legs almost became a kind of vehicle for materials, for your kind of exploration of materials. Like you were talking about Pesce earlier in your admiration for his use of materials. But that's something that, again, like... the iconography of those legs, but also something that's very unique to you is this idea of like using maybe like oat cakes or seaweed or lichen or, you know, these kind of natural food products or, you know, things that exist within nature contrasted with, you know, the perspex of the legs that become almost like a framing device to sort of show these materials really up close somehow. Like, is that correct?
Yeah, I'd say so. Because, you know, sometimes you might see something of interest around you in the street or whatever, and it's like, how do you frame, how can you frame that? Like, how can you, and how can I frame that in the way in which I think it's really special too? Like, how could you kind of, I don't know, jazz it up or ham it up in such a way? Like, how can you make that into something theatrical? Like, the theatricality of looking, I think, is really key to me. So I think, remember looking at these kind of sushi nori, those kind of sheets of seaweed that you get, and then thinking, oh, it's quite like the wool of a Chanel suit. Like, how could I get that? You know, but it's going to fall apart. So just if you put it between these kind of layers of perspex and put them in a leg, then it also reminds me of these kind of photo frames that we would have around the house when I was younger. You know, those kind of hinged
clip frames.
Yeah.
Used to get them from Athena.
Yeah.
Yes. Long R.I.P. Athena.
I think I always really liked the idea, you know, like when you have like minerals or crystals or rocks that have kind of old insects hidden inside, or like fossils.
Like Jurassic Park, like that kind of like in amber.
Natural history kind of thing. And even that watermelon that you made as an addition, I think, for Hepworth Wakefield, the way it's like cut into the fruit and then you see the inside through that kind of glass-like object. Like that has that same kind of... It's almost like capturing a moment in time or something.
Yeah, I'd say. I quite like the idea of, I think often, like, as well as there being kind of these, like, fixed motifs, sometimes there's motifs like that about how do we capture time or what kind of speed of something might there be. Like, if you think about glass, it's just been this kind of, it's gone from being a solid to a liquid and then cooled back into a solid again. So it's about how you've captured this material at a certain moment. Like, a piece of sushi is like, sushi seaweed been, you know, in the sea, then it's rolled and it's flattened and it's dried and now it's stuck in a sculpture. These kind of things of trapping things at certain moments.
And are you worried about things breaking down?
I just close my eyes.
Do you? What did these glass blowers think when you came to them with this design for this volcanic business table?
Oh, they were great.
Were they?
They were really great. Yeah, and there was the one I kind of did most of the correspondence with, he was French. I don't really speak any French, like kind of cafe French, and his English was not so great. So he communicated with me through these kind of really amazing set of drawings that were these kind of cartoons of how the process would be. So these kind of, it doesn't really work.
But like someone, with cartoon eyes blowing a big pipe with a glass at the end, and then how that would move from the next stage to the next stage.
Yeah, and I think in the same way there was that yes with Ruba about the butt. It was like, you know, this is a yes, you know, someone who can communicate really clearly through cartoon drawing about what it means to make a table out of glass. This is definitely someone that I can work with.
And that must cost a lot of money to fabricate something like that. How do you fund these projects in your mind?
In my mind,
easily. But when it comes to fruition, it's like, well, a table like that going to like these kind of genius glass makers must cost money.
This was a commission that was from a Swiss watch company called Constantin Vacheron. Mm-hmm. So they funded all of it, and it was something that was initially meant to go into their collection afterwards. Yeah. So I think, you know, there are, I don't know, there's ways to kind of keep hustling.
Navigate that. And how do they feel about that, then not going into their collection and going into another designer's?
I think they offered it back to me, shall we say. They said, oh, you can have it back now. And then suddenly you're kind of left with a big glass
to store.
Table. Yeah, right, to right, store. Right. So then I was very lucky that it got to go to the Lyon Biennial, so then it travelled straight to Lyon, and then from Lyon it went to the Hepworth.
Right.
Yeah, because storing work's a nightmare. There's something that really interesting in that whole topic, that I remember a period of time, I think when you stopped working with Ibid because they went to Los Angeles, and then you were very... sort of firm in the idea that you were just going to have time out from being in the gallery system, and you made a number of years where you were just like on your own in the studio, and yes, you continued doing public exhibitions, and I guess that's probably how you survived, because you were getting commissions from different spaces that might give you budgets to create shows, but you really sort of managed to somehow just focus on your art on your terms. Mm-hmm. And I remember having so much respect for that and the kind of patience you had, and you knew that's what you needed at that time.
And so many people must have questioned you at that time. I know I did at one point go, who are you going to go with next? And I remember you looking at me and going like, I don't know, I don't want to be with anyone at the minute. And mm-hmm. I remember being a bit like, oh, really? Okay. And it felt like you've put yourself in no man's land happily. It's like you, as an artist, mm-hmm. without like representation, that was so brave to do at the time, right?
It didn't feel brave. It felt like the only way to do things. I think the relationship I had with that gallery at the time, we'd both started working together when we were both very young, as a gallery and as an artist. Mm. And, you know, we were no longer thinking the same way about the directions we wanted to take. And then I think I had some just amazing peers, you know, like I had people I could trust that I could speak to about things.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's kind of one of the most important things. And then, you know, other stuff, yeah, just kind of came up along the way. And, it was actually, you know, I'm happy now with things, but also it was really great, and it was good to know that all the decisions that were coming my way were, or that I was making were on my terms, and everything was about looking each other in the eye. And there was never, it was all so straightforward in a way. You know, it was always just like, if someone wanted to ask a question about the work, they had to come to me.
Yeah.
Which is quite empowering, really.
If you think of younger artists these days, often the question I get asked as a gallerist is, how do I get a gallery? Mm-hmm. How do I get shows? All this stuff. And they're all concerned with almost having the representation as if that's the end goal. But what I think a lot of people forget is the representation is something that comes when the artist has kind of formed their universe. And it's kind of actually not the key. In having gallery representation, it's more about trying to develop your practice and your collaborations and connections with other artists, actually.
Would you do the same thing again?
If I needed to, then I would, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if it would work in the same way. You know, I was also younger, so I had more energy. You know, like I had to do so many other things to finance my life at that time, which I could have...
Well, you teach as well now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's, you know, teaching's not... Unfortunately, it's not quite enough to kind of keep everything going. But it's also good because then it kind of keeps you talking.
Yes.
I think that's one really great thing about teaching, is that you're constantly having to think on your feet and check your own ideas as well as what the students are presenting with you. Because they're not wrong. They're kind of what's coming next. And
Has being a mum changed your work?
Yeah. Yeah, in every way. I guess you just have a completely different set of priorities, which is quite tough to kind of... get one's head around. It's kind of great, but also difficult too.
Have you had any work that you can actually link to an experience of being with your kid, that you've gone, oh, I'm going to create art from this?
Not so much, not in that way. I guess like time-wise, I remember like the Sculpture Centre exhibition was like, absolutely. I remember like having 2 hours between like breastfeeds and having to like go to Aaron Angel's Troy Town Pottery, do some ceramics, and then go back again. It's like, all right, I've got 2 hours. Does it really matter what I'm going to make? Yeah, maybe, but also let's just get on with it. And I know that's kind of a cliche that you hear people say. It's like, it's not so much that you make decisions quicker. It's just you're kind of operating in a different way.
Right.
Yeah, it's more like strict, isn't it? The amount of time you have.
Or streamlined. Do you streamline everything?
I'm not streamlined. I never figured out streamlining something. But you just kind of roll with it. You just kind of have to kind of change gear, but not in a way of speeding up. You just, I don't know. You just run out of time for other things. It's like, well, that's that done then. So
yeah.
Time to go back.
Interesting. So talking of teaching, this year, mm-hmm. 2020, you're going to be teaching at Open School East in Margate.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, and that's quite a unique thing, isn't it? Because it's free, the education, like you apply to study there, and they have different programs, including a master's program, which is what I think you'll be teaching on, like the equivalent of a master's. And it's a year-long program, and it's got a lot to do with public programming and kind of collaboration. So I imagine as a teacher that's going to be quite a fascinating thing. But I just heard, because I've just joined the Board of Trustees, but they were saying that they actually allow the teacher to dictate and curate and create the program completely, so there's no kind of fixed rules as such.
No, I think that's also the best kind of teacher that I can be. When it comes to lesson plans, that's not happening. But, you know, but I think one thing I didn't learn when I was at art school is what an artist actually does.
Right.
You kind of learn about art history a little bit, or you learn about, I don't know, some other stuff, and you learn about being with other people, but you don't actually know on a day-to-day basis what artists do.
Yeah.
It's quite a mystery, in fact. You know, you just kind of leave and then...
Have you worked it out now?
I'm doing something. But I got a feeling I'm not doing the thing that other people are doing.
Right.
I'm always checking when I see friends, like, what time do you wake up in the morning? Like,
what time do you go to the studio?
Yeah,
what time?
Yeah. How many emails do you respond to every day?
Yeah. But then I think part of that is that it is so personal, and that everyone's such a different personality that you have to just find what that is for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's unique, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you like teaching?
I like talking to people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think I've had a lot of really great teaching roles. I think it could have just happened. I think I've had lots of really good timing. I don't want to just sound like I'm very lucky or something, but, you know, like I had a really good teaching post at Chelsea one year where I could go in and I did a lot of mime with these students. It was great, and we had a lot of fun. And then we went to Oslo and did a mime performance there. Then we came back and did something else. And I could also, there was also budget to bring in my collaborators, like the people, like the hip-hop dancers that I work with, or my kind of... people that I really admire, you know, like to get in Alex Padfield, who's like a young artist, and get them in to speak to my students about what they do. So I get the benefit of spending time with someone I admire and combining that with like sharing my excitement with that person with some students too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's often me not really teaching. It's just more like showing other people the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what will happen at Open School East too, that I think I framed it that we're going to make a film. You know, I'm always forever pitching this film. We're going to make a film which is somehow connected to the idea of how muses function. You know, like what a muse is and what a muse does somehow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, great.
Yeah,
I just saw a new book about that. It has Frida Kahlo on the cover and somebody else, I can't remember, and it was about this idea that what is the muse and... in the history...
Historical muses.
And how people like Frida almost resisted...
Being the muse
somehow and tried to subvert it. And yeah, it's quite an interesting feminist book.
So as you talk about mime again, it feels like theatre and opera and ballet are again huge motifs in your work. Theatricality, what we were saying.
Yeah.
Do you go and see a lot of dance and ballet? And when was the first time you really realised that this was something important to you?
I don't think I've ever seen a ballet.
Really?
No. Too fancy.
So interesting.
But what is it? When did you realise that like dance was quite a big, or like movement especially?
But also, you've referenced people like John Travolta
in
your work.
1970s
disco. Yeah, kind of 70s disco. That kind of seems some sort of undercurrent within
like
your work.
Dance and movement.
I guess so. Yeah, it's true. I can't deny that. But I guess often when there's like a difference between like a reference and something that I'm interested in. Like, you know, like you can bring in John Travolta as like a cultural motif, right? Like I'm not actually into John Travolta personally.
Yeah.
But he's got quite a clear, or that 1970s figure has quite a clear cultural reading.
Yeah.
Like, you know what that means? It's kind of like this cheesy suit. It's kind of a particular type of masculinity. This kind of like, I don't know, plastic clothes, you know, it kind of has all these different readings. So when you drop that into a work, it kind of places it in a particular space. And I think that ballet does that too, you know, like if you're kind of creating ballet, that's something. But if you're referencing ballet, it also speaks of something which is kind of, I don't know, more specialized, something more refined about a particular type of person who might go to the ballet, about a particular type of person who might do ballet. Yeah. And also it speaks to those people who are not part of that too. It kind of makes these kind of like spaces.
So it's like a class divide in some ways.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
And also in some of your earlier work, you included imagery of people like Karl Lagerfeld, but it wasn't the Karl Lagerfeld that we knew at that time, who was like an older man with grey hair and kind of like very eccentric clothes and everything, like black and white clothes. But it's a black and white photograph of him, but as a young man, kind of very like you're saying, that kind of like 70s masculinity. And is that the same kind of idea then? And also that print that we made for Counter Editions of like Pasta Man.
Yeah.
With these, you kind of use these images.
Alpha male. Sort
males, kind of very dreamy as well somehow. Mm-hmm. Kind of like perfect hair and...
Perfect hair.
Yeah.
I guess I think I like those images of men because you couldn't really... They were just impervious. Like they didn't care. They didn't... Maybe not Karl Lagerfeld, maybe that was slightly different. But for the print that we made, like that guy... He was hot. He didn't care whether I kind of chopped him up or turned him into a photo. Like, he's still good looking, you know. Like, he's living in the bubble of his own handsomeness, immortalized in print. And I don't know, probably been exploited elsewhere by, you know, everything else that's going on around him. But I think the reason why I like that Karl Lagerfeld photo is that it was Karl Lagerfeld. He's kind of quite a typical kind of beary, beefy guy.
Yeah.
Which fits into kind of one stream of type of images. But when you realise that Karl Lagerfeld, this kind of like cultural producer and icon, had kind of passed through that image into something else, it's kind of like, you know, if you plant a seed and that seed knows what's going to grow into, but if you kind of find a seed on the floor, you don't know what it's going to be, it could turn into anything. You know, this kind of idea that within one figure there's like a history and kind of vice versa.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I remember being so startled by that and just being like, that's Karl Lagerfeld. Like, it just felt so alien to me. It's almost like if you look at someone like Marc Jacobs as well, because he suddenly, he went through these different visual kind of representations of himself and became that kind of muscle guy. And he sort of really evolved, didn't he? It's kind of fascinating. Mm. Or even Lee McQueen. It kind of happens a lot in fashion, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Amazing. So we ask every guest that comes on two important questions. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, you could have any work of art in the world, whatever you choose, you're touched on artwork and you can keep it and we'll help you take it.
And it can be like as big as you want or as small as you want.
What
could
would
go
it
in your
be?
Pocket, or we can and bring a crane.
What would that be and why?
I find it kind of difficult, this, because I don't really believe in like one-off, you know, like you might change your mind along the way, mm-hmm. but maybe I would have like a collection of skyscrapers.
A collection of skyscrapers?
Yeah.
Wow.
What do you mean? Like what
from where? From what country?
Maybe from all over, you know, like a key ring. But so maybe I would have like the Burj Khalifa and the Chrysler. Yeah, the Chrysler building.
Beautiful.
I like that CCTV building that's in China.
The Is one it in Hong Kong or...?
Is it?
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know that one.
I'm sorry.
Would you take Canary Wharf, the original skyscraper?
No, but I might have the monument, because that used to be the tallest building in London.
The Fire of London monument.
Ooh. Yeah, yeah. So I might have that.
Have you been up inside that?
No, of course not.
You can go up it.
I don't really like heights very much.
Don't you?
No, I don't know where I put them, but you know, just around.
I quite like this idea. You said a key ring. So you've got these giant. No, I know, but you said the word key ring, and I was just thinking like these giant buildings on a tiny scale.
Like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids to all these skyscrapers, isn't it?
Yeah, but no, I'd have them at real size, so you could compare them.
Oh my God!
Like you do in them drawings.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Probably
Burj Khalifa is still the tallest building in the world, isn't it?
I think for now, yeah.
For now.
Yeah, I like that. It's a finite experience that building gets to have until someone else comes along.
Until Anthea Hamilton comes along and does a giant skyscraper key ring of all of them together.
Yeah.
Good one.
Amazing. Yeah.
The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
Oh, my 8-year-old niece asked me this question yesterday, so I know.
Really?
I don't know what the colour's called. It's kind of like a pale, almost neon violet lilac colour.
Ooh.
A neon lilac violet.
Yeah, kind of a neon, but also pastel. It's kind of a colour that does quite a lot.
Have you used it in your work yourself?
I've got one crayon that's that colour that I like a lot.
Wow.
What do you use the crayon on?
Nothing, I just look at it.
Really?
Yeah, I really like it.
As like a sculptural form?
No, just look at it.
Just as an object.
Do you collect, do you collect things? I know you have an archive of images, but do you collect anything else in your life?
I try not to, but then I kind of binge and then buy loads of stuff. So I've just bought loads of glass... berries.
Glass berries?
Like glass blackberries and glass...
But like 1970s, 80s, like retro ones?
No,
or...
I think they're new.
Are they?
They're new, yeah.
But like single berries, or are they clumps? Like
no,
used to
singles.
Go...
Like that's the single one. Like
where'd you get them from?
All over the place.
But what...
Belgium. These ones come from.
So how do you display them? In like a bowl as if they're fruit? You know, you should go to people's houses and they'd like them ceramic bowls of like ceramic fruit, which was just so random. Is it like that sort of thing?
I don't know what I'm going to do with them. They're on bits of metal at the moment. Sometimes I don't know if things are for me.
Yeah.
for my life or if things are going to be artworks or somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I just kind of enjoy them for that. And then,
wow.
Yeah, it's like actually, the crayon. It's
that, that's interesting because that makes me think about something. In the shows, since like the early, you know, exhibitions you've done, there's always been this sense of looking and the way you create a way you can walk through an exhibition and kind of there's an idea of the gaze or something, but like it's very much about looking and like with the kimonos and even with, I remember your husband and you, Nicholas Byrne, you guys did like a fashion project years and years ago that I actually have still, the rope.
Mm-hmm.
And even that idea of like wearing things that you, if you wore them, people are going to look at you. Do you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. the things you're highlighting are very
like
visual.
The brick suit you were saying.
Yeah, or
like,
the brick suit, exactly, yeah. What is that all about? Like, is that deliberate or is that just
to
sort of try and make people look?
I think it's just that I know that people do look anyway, which sounds like quite a vague thing to say.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like giving them, their eyes, a place to pause on something in a way.
Like, yeah, and I guess if you're going to a gallery, you're there to look, aren't you?
Yeah, and it's normally quite paced. It's like, there's one thing, and there's another thing, and there's another thing. So understanding, again, it's like about tempo. Like, I kind of read, like, what
rhythm.
A tempo.
Yeah, again,
I read,
like dance what, rhythm.
Yeah. So it's nice, like, with the dance thing, that you can, like, pick up, like, a four-to-the-floor disco beat from one thing and then, like, transpose that to Tate Britain, you know? Like, you can get people to kind of move in a disco way or, like, in a R&B way rather than in a kind of a museum kind of ploddy way.
Yeah. Do you ever have ever in your mind what you want people to take away from your work when they experience it?
No.
Never.
I guess I know that I see things in one particular way. And normally I've like spoken things out with enough people that I can understand where things will be misunderstood. Mm. And as long as I'm all right with those misunderstandings, even if I definitely if I don't agree with them, I understand that so be it. It's not I don't know, it's like this thing about empathy again. It's like, well, I guess I feel like it's this project, The Squash, which was quite like a big project for me. It's like I knew that how the audience were going to see it, that were coming into the museum, was going to be really different to how I and the people who made the project felt about it. And so we had to kind of just let that be.
But you always see yourself as the first viewer, right?
Yeah.
And you had a bit, I think I read you had a bit of a conundrum when you became like Instagram fodder for the Butt, because people were having pictures by the entrance to the Butt or next to the Butt because it was great. And in some ways, that's an amazing celebration of what you created. But also you found that quite troubling in some ways.
It was only troubling that then there would be people thinking that I'd done that on purpose. You know, like the idea that I would...
Like controversial.
Oh, like you created an artwork for Instagram or something.
Like a sensational.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Which I guess even if Instagram wasn't there, it's that same thing of the Turner Prize. It's the sensationalism of art, which is not something that I go for. I think things can be kind of visually surprising, but not necessarily sensation, you know, a sensationalist experience. I'm kind of, despite all of the things which I do, I'm really against gimmicks. And so the idea that it could have been read as that, I think that was the thing that was annoying.
Yeah, I think you have the potential, though, to... What I loved about what you said earlier is that you liked to stay... You came above the radar and now you went below the radar. But you I think you have the ability, as Anthony Hamilton, to create work that is really attention-seeking. But
also that connects on a mass level.
Yes, exactly. But I think what you do is you really edit yourself to be really pure with what you want to put out there in the world. And I think that's... an amazing thing, amazing, that you do have that ability in yourself. Because I feel like you have these ideas, but you really streamline, which you don't think you do, but I think you really streamline these ideas to being the purest of what they can be.
I'd say that would be great if that's what's happening.
I think it is.
But actually, earlier on, we were talking about that film from like one of the first things you ever did after you left college, which was you, it's like a VHS tape where it's like a still shot, one shot, film, and it's you singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow but really slowed down. And it was in a show that I saw at Tate, curated by Sonia Boyce, the British artist, and that really in a way is the kind of like beginning of, you know, your career, wasn't it? Like, and was that one of the first times you were exhibited?
Yeah, and it was in Tate. And it was a film that I'd made when I was 19, so yeah. I guess you go from graduating to kind of ticking one kind of big thing off the list.
Yeah.
In a way. And I really still stand by that film. I think it's that thing of choosing a very particular thing from popular culture that should hopefully read to as many people as possible, and then understanding how that you can personally connect with that, or how you kind of adopt things and then make them your own.
Yeah.
And then you have a very personal relationship to them, but other people can do that too. It's kind of like, I don't know, this spinning around of something. That's not a very good way to say it. But
no, it is, though. And that's interesting, because I think, like what Russell's saying, there's some sort of purity in that work, which is almost like a bit like this idea of the grain and then what that grows into. But there was something there in that work which has continued throughout. It's like the kind of DNA, in a way, of what you became. And even the way that you slowed down the audio in that video. So it's kind of making you respond to this very iconic song that we all know inside out. You know, you've heard it millions of times through our lives, especially, you know, being born at the time we've all been born. So you're sort of making people, you know, look again, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, if you can get people to do that, I guess that's...
You're winning as an artist.
Yeah.
We have a lot of young artists listen to this. What advice would you give? And I know that you're a teacher, so you must give advice day in, day out. But what advice would you give to a young artist listening of how to get into the art world?
God, my advice is terrible.
Go on.
Because I always say to my students, like, don't pay attention to this, just do what you want. And then they all end up like having to redo bits of the course and stuff.
Oh, no. So you basically make their lives harder.
Don't listen to them. Don't
they're like,
really...
yeah, let's rebel. And they're like, oh, shit. I've just wasted another X amount of money on this course.
But that's the bizarre thing, though, about creative education, is that, like, they have all these rules and strict guidelines because they have to prove that people have actually learned something. Yeah. But then creativity isn't really... You can't cage creativity.
In a box to check. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I think just go for it. I think don't compromise. I think that's it. I think that's something that I tried not to do for as long as possible. It's like, just don't... If you feel like a compromise run coming near you, just like run for the hills, away from that. And I think you should know that people are interested. I think that's difficult to know when you're a younger artist, is that people are actually really interested in what you do.
Yeah.
And that people are really looking. Like, right, you guys are looking all the time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're interested, and just to kind of keep going and keep doing shows and putting your stuff out there, wherever it is people put their work these days, and wait and be patient. And in 1 year, it's not a long time. And don't expect to make money for ever.
Ever in your life.
Ever. Yeah.
And something that I've heard from a number of different artists, including Zadie Char, who was a previous guest on our podcast, actually, and who I worked with at the gallery a bit before she started exhibiting extensively. But her friendship with you has been really, like, important to her. And I think it really helped her, you know, feel like she wasn't alone, because I think some of the concerns that she has are not the same, but they're in a similar kind of, you know, you're both coming from a similar place in some way. And I think that's really important to remember as well, is the idea of, like, talking to other artists and friendships and how you can look out for each other.
Well, your peers yeah. are really important, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of my time is punctuated by very long kind of cups of tea sessions with people.
Mm.
And they're really important. Like, I need to kind of see, there are certain people I need to see to kind of make to make sense of things.
Yeah,
and the art of conversation.
Yeah.
What is next for Anthea Hamilton?
What is next? Some really exciting things. One thing that I hoped I'd be able to tell you about, but I can't because it's not announced yet. And then I'm working on a performance for The Walker in Minneapolis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What, along the lines of the squash or something completely different?
Who knows? It's really soon. And as ever, things take me forever to kind of resolve.
Is it from a found image?
I don't know.
Oh, wow.
I don't know.
There's one thing, a quote that you said, though, about that found image of the man dressed as the squash vegetable, is that you wanted to make work from this image for what it may feel like. You wanted to make work that made what this image felt like. And that's, for me, just like an amazing way of approaching making work, is that you look at a picture and you think, what would this feel like realised in the world? Is that a theme that goes through most of your kind of ideas?
Yeah. I'd say so. Like, I'm quite somehow, I don't know, I quite like the physicality of things, or things being real, you know, like, but also I know that we don't often get to touch things, I was kind of repeating that, but we don't get to touch things in museums, and so things have to satisfy us enough through our eyes in a way that you can kind of feel what that might feel like. Or I guess what was nice about that image is you could imagine yourself in that position, or you can imagine looking at that person and maybe no one having any idea what was going on too. It was really complex, that image. I'm kind of still unravelling it, and there was lots of other kind of ideas that came up through that. But
Where are they now, the costumes?
They're just in storage. I think because they're not artworks, really. They kind of, the whole of that project kind of exists in a funny realm that kind of really just existed for 6 months in a way. So, yeah, they're just kind of being looked after carefully.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's really open, that image, isn't it? Like, it's something that there's not necessarily like a verbal response to, but you can kind of get what's going on with it. Mm. Maybe just simply because it's stripes, and stripes are kind of visually successful also.
Mm.
Yeah.
The Minneapolis, you're working on this project.
Yeah.
And that's the next thing on your radar, and this other thing, this super secret, exciting thing you can't talk about.
Yeah. They're both two really new things. You know, to do something right. in the US.
Oh, they're both in the US.
One of them's here, but okay. a really different type of project. And the other one is here. Yeah, just showing, I guess, like, to work in the UK, you kind of know the audience if you're British, and you kind of know how people kind of react to things.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
You feel the same way about stuff. But
the British sensibility.
Yeah, the British sensibility. Queuing, things like that.
Yeah. We love a queue, yeah.
Yeah.
What is success to you as well?
I don't know. I guess I have an idea of maybe what other people think success is. I don't know. You mean on a very personal level?
Yeah.
Or because you know, you think of you now being this international artist who's getting opportunities to show in museums or public spaces or private galleries all over the world, or biennales. Mm. So on the outside, that's probably what the world would think is success.
Mm-hmm.
But to you, I've got a feeling that probably isn't the end goal, even though, yes, you want to communicate and have a platform for your work, I guess. But yeah, I was just intrigued.
I guess common sensically, when I was studying, when I did my MA, and that was in painting, and I wasn't making painting, and I was making all these kind of sculptures made from bits of, I don't know, bits and pieces and ETs and things like that, then I knew that I knew that I wanted my work to be in museums, always. Right. I think I always knew that if I was going to be an artist, I wanted work to be in museums so many people could see it. And maybe that was egotistically, but it was also just for the broader conversation as a work could have,
right,
as such. And so that I get to do that, it's like, oh, that's what I meant, so good, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know what success is. I guess being able to keep the work being interested to other people and to oneself, like, you know, just to not go on repeat, because then that's not being successful, that's just, I don't know, responding to other people's ideas of what you do or something.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so growing, I guess, over time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On one's own terms. Yeah.
Amazing.
Cool.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, looking forward to continuing this journey together, because like, it's really bizarre how I feel like we've both, well, I guess we're a similar age as well, though.
Mm.
But it is really exciting to sort of be...
catch up now in 2020.
Audience for your work.
Yeah.
I've really enjoyed it, so thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And for everyone listening, you can see images of many of the artworks we have discussed in today's episode at our Instagram, which is @talkart.
Have you got an Instagram?
Yeah, I don't really use it.
You don't?
I was going to say, I thought you did, but you don't post much, do you?
Oh, it's so stressful. I can't
really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I need to find a theme.
Grapes. Little glass grapes
and
berries. Just everyone.
I'll hit that today.
hit that hard on your grid. Yeah.
what is your Instagram? @HamiltonAnthea or something?
Yeah.
It's the other way around, isn't it? Yeah, HamiltonAnthea.
Yeah.
Good one. And we'll be back very soon.
Thank you very much,
Thanks
Anthea.
Thanks for listening. Thanks, Anthea.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.